Hi, this is Andrew Corbett, and welcome again to our study of Paul's Epistle to the Colossians. This is study number 8, A Different Vision. It's based on Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 to 4, which says this: If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. So this is a different vision. And again, if you're meeting via Zoom, it's a little bit difficult to offer tea and coffee, but I hope that people have got their tea and coffee or whatever beverage they're using if they're watching this via Zoom, or if you're watching this after the lockdown is finished and you're able to do something like that, a hot or cold drink and a snack or something, just to create that sense of camaraderie, then please, I would encourage you to do that. Even if you are meeting by Zoom, I would encourage a go around and sense of go around and ask people one thing you're thankful for, one thing you would like prayer for. Maybe have someone else in the group note the prayer points. If you are using Zoom, you can share a whiteboard and someone can be actually writing on that whiteboard as people share prayer requests. And then at the end of the meeting, I would encourage you to lead the group through praying for those different prayer requests from each member of the group. But by asking people one thing they're thankful for, really what you're doing is giving people an opportunity to be able to share something that's going on in their world, something that's happening in their life. And even their thank point could also be a prayer point. So bear that in mind. And as usual, I would strongly recommend, encourage different ones in the group to read a paragraph or read a question out with the Bible reference, so that you're keeping people on their toes and you're also involving people. Okay, the first paragraph says this: Have you ever heard the criticism of someone that they were so heavenly minded they were of no earthly good? It's usually directed toward people who use their spirituality as an excuse for avoiding their practical responsibilities around their home or in the workplace. Now, at that point, if you're leading this and you're reading this out, you might just want to stop there and say, has anyone ever heard this? Or has anyone ever seen this? Or have you offered this criticism of someone? Tell us what that looked like. Over the years, I've heard different stories from Christian employers, Christian managers, who have said, you know, we get a reputation as a quote-unquote Christian business. We have Christians come to us. They want to work for us. They take an extra 15 minutes at lunchtime because they're studying their Bible, and they're just sure that's okay. They might take an extra 5 or 10 minutes at smoko break or something because they're witnessing to another staff member and they think that's okay, when in fact, it's stealing. It's robbing time from the time that their employer is paying them. It can be a really poor witness. And sometimes people use the excuse, well, you know, the eternal consequence of me taking that 5 minutes to witness to someone was far more important than the 5 minutes I didn't work, or something like that. Anyway, I hope that becomes a bit of a topic of discussion through the group meeting. But the expression of this type of criticism is misguided because, the criticism's not misguided, but the way it's expressed is, because the more heavenly-minded a person becomes, the more practical and responsible they become. The greatest example of this was Jesus. So, you know, when we consider how practical Jesus was, yet how deeply, in fact, ultimately spiritual he was. There was no one more spiritual than Christ. Yet he worked for some 30 years, close to 30, up until the age of 30, I should say, as a carpenter. And presumably the last 10 years of that or so was him supporting his mother and quite possibly his brothers and sisters through carrying on the carpentry business of Joseph of Nazareth, who presumably had died when Christ was maybe somewhere in the vicinity of his later teen years or early 20s. So Christ was very, very practical. And we think of the times when Christ, you know, washed his disciples' feet. That was a pretty practical move. And yet he had a clearer vision of heaven than anyone. So that's why the expression of that criticism is probably not accurate. Okay, question one. What kind of vision of Christ is the Apostle Paul encouraging believers to have in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 1, which says, "If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God." Now again, we put into the context of this the big backdrop. The backdrop of the Gnostics saying Christ was just a man. He was no one particularly special. He couldn't have been God because, you know, the claim is that God became flesh. Well, God's so pure and holy, he could never become flesh because flesh and material things are evil and wicked. But here the apostle says, Christ is not only in heaven, he's not only been raised from the dead, Christ is raised, but Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Not standing, but seated at the right hand of God, which is a way of saying he is divine. He is divine. And so the one who became flesh now is in heaven seated at the right hand of God. So what kind of vision should we have of Christ? We should have a vision of Christ as the ultimate Lord. That's the vision we should have of Christ. Now, I originally put this little anecdote in the first person when I talked about my own motorcycle rider career. I rode professionally. I rode a motorcycle for quite a few years. And in that time, I had to undertake advanced motorcycle rider training programs as part of my work. And I decided I won't put it in the first person. I'll just make it a general comment. So here comes the general comment. When motorcyclists undertake an advanced rider training program, one of the most important things the trainers will emphasize is that when a motorcyclist is faced with a dangerous situation, they need to look where they are going, not at the danger in front of them. And this is the catch cry. Look where you want to go is the motorcyclist's mantra to keep them safe on the road. There is a spiritual parallel to this. And I remember doing several these motorcycle rider training programs where you would have to be sort of riding through a course of witches hats on the training ground, and then they might throw something in front of you, and if you your most natural impulse is to look at it, you know, whether it be, you know, it could have been a bag of something, it could have been a different colored witch's hat, it could have been something, and the idea was they were trying to get you not to look at it, but to look where you had to go and rely on your peripheral vision. So it wasn't that you couldn't see the imminent danger. It was that you didn't focus on the imminent danger. And I remember doing this thinking, boy, that's a powerful spiritual parallel, I think, for how we are to live our life, walking in the Spirit, walking with God. So that's the point I make. There is a spiritual parallel to this, and here it is, or here's a part of it. The enemy of our soul wants to distract us, but the Holy Spirit leads us to focus on God. This is why worship, there's the blanks to fill in there, of God is so important for our spiritual health. Question two. How did Christ model this based on Hebrews 12 verse 2, which says, "Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God." So there, that the writer of the Hebrews, the epistle to the Hebrews, is saying the same point. But consider this, Christ, as he went to the cross, his focus, well, it says, "who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame." So for the joy set before him, and the joy set before him was to be pleasing to his Father. So his focus was on his Father. His focus was on God. And that's that the biggest thing that could have distracted him was going to the cross. And so we read in chapter 12 and verse 3, the next verse, "Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted." So consider the distractions that Christ had at that time. Pummeled by Roman soldiers, mocked by the crowds, despised by the religious leaders, criticized either side of him, left and right, from the thieves who were crucified either side of him. He had a lot going on, and yet his focus was on the joy set before him throughout all this. That's an amazing example of how we are to remain focused so that we're not distracted by what the enemy might throw at us. Question three. Consider Colossians chapter 3, verse 2, which says, "Set your mind on things that are above, not on things that are on earth." Does this verse mean that the believer no longer needs to concern themselves with such mundane earthly things as house cleaning, washing their car, or weeding their garden? Discuss. Well, I hope that the discussion says it goes along the lines of, you can still be a prayerful person. You can still take time to read the Bible. You can still witness about your faith in Christ and what Christ has done for you, and wash your car and mow your lawn and clean your house and iron your clothes and hang the washing out and take the dog for a walk and all those other mundane, so-called mundane things. It is said, and I don't know if it's true, it could just be legendary, but it is said of Francis of Assisi that someone came to him while he was tending the monastery's veggie patch and said, "What would you do if you knew you only had a few minutes left to live?" And Francis said, "I would finish weeding this veggie patch." Oh, that's profound. That he saw that as a part of living a godly life, doing some of these mundane things. Christianity is marked by a conversion. Now we jump into Ephesians. And the reason we jump into Ephesians is because Ephesians and Colossians are sister epistles. They were written at the same time. They were to be interchanged. In other words, the Colossians were to read their epistle, hand it over to the church at Ephesus, and vice versa. The church at Ephesus was to read their epistle and make a copy and send it over to the Colossians. So in Ephesians chapter 2, verses 1 to 5, how does this passage describe conversion to Christianity? Does Colossians 3:3 support that? So Ephesians chapter 2, verses 1 to 5 says, "And you were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, like the rest of mankind. But God, being rich in mercy, because of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved." So there's the description in Ephesians chapter 2, verses 1 to 5, which says, before you came to Christ, you were dead, spiritually dead, and now you've been made alive. Colossians 3:3 says this, "For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God." So you have died, and yet Paul says you have a life. So in other words, you were dead spiritually. And when you came to Christ, you died to an old way of living. And now you have been resurrected spiritually, and you live according to the principles of following Christ and obeying Christ. So is there a connection between those two passages? Absolutely. So before coming to Christ, we were spiritually dead, but now spiritually, God has now spiritually, so to speak, resurrected us. All right, I introduced this word, eschatology. I've even got it there in phonetics, eschatology. It's the study of what the Bible teaches about last things. This is sometimes referred to as end times or last days. Note John chapter 6, verses 39 to 41, where it refers to on the last day, and on the last day the dead will be raised, and so on. Okay, so with that in mind, we read question 5. Read Hebrews chapter 1, verse 2, which says, "But in these last days," notice when, "but in these last days, spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom also he created the world. So the writer of Hebrews is saying, this is the last days, these last days. And note the time frame the writer of Hebrews stated for these last days. And the time frame is now. So he's saying that at the time of Hebrews, the epistle to the Hebrews being written, it was the last days. So sometimes we read that with our very 21st lens on, I suppose, looking at this and going, ah, that's referring to our day. This was a prophecy of, years and years, 2,000 years to come. But that doesn't make sense because it's describing these last days. So that was the context of that expression. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 4, so the last verse in the section that we're looking at, is an eschatological statement. So in other words, it has something to do with the end or the last things. It says this, when Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Paul is telling the Colossians two important things about the future. First, Christ will return. The Greek word means will be revealed. And secondly, when Christ returns, the righteous will be resurrected. This would have been a major attack on what the Gnostics taught about the value of the human body. So remember that? The human body, they said, was basically corrupt. It was evil. It was of no moral value. But if it's going to be resurrected, it must have great value. All right. Question 6. Based on the apostles' allusion to the believer's resurrection in Colossians 3:4, does this mean that there is no point in spending time and effort on improving our physical health and condition? 1 Timothy 4:8 says, "For while bodily training is of some value, godliness is of value in every way, as it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come." Discuss. And I hope the discussion says, look, there's a balance. You really should look after your body, your mind, and your soul. Well, may God grant us a fresh and clearer vision of His supremacy and His lordship based on this short study of Colossians chapters 3, verses 1 to 4.